Hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book In Broken Water by Adlard Coles. We're on chapter 10, and this is the sixth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 10. More trouble in Germany. On August the 12th, Sunday, we were ready for sea. Our new mast was stepped and looked very strong after the reed-like stick it had replaced. Mr. S. joined us, and we sailed across Kiel Fjord to Holtenau Locks at the east end of the canal. In the roads, hundreds of ships were lying, as there was a strike of pilots in the canal. Ships are not usually allowed through without a pilot, and if being towed, there must be a pilot in the tug. Mr. S. took me to the harbour master and Mr. Sluicemaster, a lavishly uniformed and somewhat pompous individual to whom we paid due respect as we wanted to go through the Kiel Canal with the first convoy. This was agreed as a privilege to a private yacht, and as there were no tugs operating, we presently towed a net through the great locks ourselves. It was thought that the strike would be over on Monday, and so we were to start at 6 o'clock on the following morning. I had paid the agent £2 at Brunsbüttel for towage when we came through before. This had seemed plenty of money, but not excessive for the use of three tugs and towing us 60 miles. However, Mr. S. explained we had been cheated, and said this time he would be our broker. This time our expenses totaled a few 100,000 marks, less than sixpence. I blessed Mr. S. In common with most people, I hate being cheated, especially by foreigners. Fortunately, I had made the brokers give me a receipt at Brunsbüttel for the money, and this I gave to Mr. S., also authorising him to act on my behalf. He wrote to the firm, and when we got to England I found a letter from him saying that the firm had inquired into the matter and had found their agents had only given them 10 shillings, keeping 30 shillings for themselves. The firm refunded the money, which was very honest of them, and dismissed their 2 employees. So I hope there will be a little more honesty in dealing with English yachts for some time to come. Monday morning arrived, but the convoy did not start, as the strike was still going on, a general strike throughout Germany threatened, and the whole position was very acute. There seemed to be a risk that we might be bottled in the canal for weeks. The country seemed on the verge of revolution, and it would be awkward for us if Bolshevism broke loose. British yachtsmen, even owners of small yachts like Annette, have the mistaken reputation of being rich. Even £20 is a fortune in Germany, and I imagined hungry mobs and all sorts of nasty things as I reflectively shook a little sand out of my revolver, which had got choked at Shear Monacook. The weapon had only cost 5 shillings originally, and it failed to inspire us with confidence. In the afternoon, Mr. S. came along and told us the strike was being settled and we should probably leave next morning. It was good news and true, as it turned out. At 6 a.m. on Tuesday, we were awakened from peaceful slumbers by the large Klaus getting ready, and soon after, we were marshalled up. 8 barges, 2 by 2, and 3 little yachts hanging on behind, Annette and the 2 Germans. The yacht alongside was called Odin and was bound for Bremen with a crew of 2 young Germans who spoke English. We made splendid progress at first, but when about 20 miles from Brunsbüttel, the convoy stopped. The tugmaster sent word back that he was going to cast off the 3 yachts, as he was towing too many ships. This was interesting, so we showed our papers, which were in order, entitling us to the first convoy. The captain repeated that he was towing too many ships, and ordered the 2 rear barges to cast off instead. No result, so the tug let go the hawser and came steaming back to the rear of the convoy. The captain, black with anger, cursed and swore. The bargees, however, merely laughed and replied, as the German yachtsman told us, "Do you take us for fools, dropping us here halfway?" The language sounded horrible, but at length the tugmaster discovered he had a telephone message from Holtenau telling him to take us all, so the towing was resumed, but only to stop again before we had moved 1/4 mile. The Kaiser Wilhelm Canal is a very, very important affair. It is larger than the Panama Canal and much more official. It has its police, called by a name sounding like Rieswaterschlosser. It has its pilots, its sluice masters, harbour masters, its brokers, its tugs and other people's tugs, but above all, it has its book of rules. A little grey book, printed in German and full of pretty pictures of signals. We, of course, did not understand a word of it. We were then with 10 other ships, which were not English, and the canal teemed with ships of all nationalities, all working on the instructions of the Little Grey Book. Everything was unsettled, and many pilots on strike, so a number of steamers were allowed through without pilots. Things somehow got wrong, and when our convoy tied up at a siding, there were 20 steamers bellowing at each other with their sirens, British, Swedish, German, Danish, and one Italian. It was rather funny to watch them hurriedly backing and getting into the siding, especially when a small English tramp, arriving in the midst of the confusion, calmly steamed through the whole lot. Eventually, all was settled, and we started again, meeting hardly any more shipping, as it all seemed to have got concentrated in the one lump. But we did not get to Brunsbüttel until 7 p.m, where the tug cast us off. Then we had another shock. No tug came to tow us through the locks, and we were told that the general strike had started. Here was a pretty state of affairs, and the bargees sent a deputation to the harbour master. The result was that we were towed into the locks at 8:30 p.m. I shall never forget the feeling of relief experienced as Annette slid slowly out between the great slimy walls to the freedom of tidal water. We tied up for the night in a deserted lock near the Odin. At 7 o'clock the next morning, there was a slight air from the southeast, and we got underway with the Odin. As the last Elbe tide was racing out and had been so for the last 2 hours, the lack of wind did not much matter. I chose the south channel, as I thought there would be more tide. The Odin went by the north. The wind backed west and the tide turned when we were half a mile off Cuxhaven, so we dropped anchor. The German yacht just managed to get into the North Harbour, so we lost the race. It came on to hard rain, but a lull came at 3:30 p.m. when the tide slackened, and we were able to sail into the harbour and tie up alongside Odin. There was a northwesterly blow the next day, so we remained in port, but on Friday, the wind having been moderate all day, we started on the ebb at 4:30 p.m. in company with the German yacht. The weather, however, looked ominous, with heavy clouds everywhere, and the glass had fallen from 30.3 to 29.8, so I came round before we had gone a mile and beat back to Cuxhaven Roads, where we dropped the hook. Little Odin pluckily carried on, and I felt a coward for giving up, but the position was complicated for strangers such as us. The mouth of the Elbe is a notoriously dangerous coast where the tide runs like a millstream and the sands extend for many miles out to sea. I was unfamiliar with the coast, and if it came on to blow, we should find ourselves hemmed in under our lee to south and east by shoals, and to the north by the rocks of Heligoland. Furthermore, beating to windward, close-reefed on a dark night, allows little time for chart work and identification of lights. It would have been foolish to have gone on, but nevertheless, we felt rather unsporting in not doing so. I was relieved when, an hour later, the Odin came back and dropped anchor near us. She had tried unsuccessfully to take the shortcut across the steel sands. It was already raining hard when she returned, so her crew came across to us and we had a cheery evening, as they were about our own age. One of them was rather funny, a solemn-faced little man, melancholy and probably of romantic disposition. Saturday found us back in Cuxhaven, while the German yacht went to Bremen by canal. We regretted the departure of Odin, as we had to lie alongside an old motorboat next to the wharf. On our bow was a spare Elbe lightship and another near our stern. These ships were temporarily the home of the homeless, where anybody could sleep and get a meal. There were a lot of boys and tramps aboard when we were there. In the evening, we felt a pull on one of our warps, and when I went on deck, found some boys trying to cast us off. It took time to cross the motorboat and scale the wharf, and needless to say, by the time I arrived, the boys were a long way off. Luckily, they were small and had not much spirit, otherwise they might have been a real nuisance. It was Saturday, and as a good number of loafers hung around the yacht, I did not quite like the look of things. Revolution was expected at any moment. Riots and robberies were an everyday occurrence. The police were inefficient. We were two young Englishmen, and as I have said before, in Germany, all Englishmen are considered rich, owners of even the smallest yachts, millionaires. One of our anchors alone meant food for a whole family for a week, and consequently, I slept that night with one eye open. Nothing happened until 4 a.m. the following morning, When I heard the pattering of bare feet on the deck, I crept to the hatch, suddenly opened it, jumped on deck, and onto the motorboat to cut off retreat. Too late. All but one of three boys escaped. I got hold of the one, intending to give him a ducking, but he was as slippery as an eel, and I slipped on the deck, which was wet with early morning dew, so he got away. Perhaps it was for the best, as there might have been some trouble. We got up and prepared breakfast, keeping an eye on the occupants of the lightships and on the boys and loafers who had gathered on the wharf. We could not understand what they said, but it was evidently threatening, and we were handicapped by being unable to reply, for Dunsterville's German was more academic than colloquial. The position was uncomfortable, for it would not be safe to leave the yacht unguarded for a moment. I foresaw that we might soon be involved in a real row with the youths and boys, supported by the other vagrants and relations and any of the population who were anti-British. And, from the look of things, there were plenty. If we retaliated, as we should have to, we should probably be involved with the police, and we did not want another Norderney. An ugly situation was therefore developing. It was blowing a northwesterly gale, but we thought the storm was preferable to the harbour. It was blowing so hard that even the largest fishing boats were in harbour, so Annette's departure under reefed storm trysail on the first of the ebb caused a sensation. The sea outside was bad, but when we got a mile from Cuxhaven out of shelter, it was dangerous. The wind was blowing straight into the teeth of the racing tide. It was too much. We came round and ran before the gale. Annette was in a bad way, each wave threatening to break aboard, so I lowered the trysail almost down, leaving only about 10 square feet showing. It blew harder and harder, and we did not dare to carry more than enough sail to drive us over the tide. Progress was thus very slow, and we had 15 miles to go before making Oost River, the nearest shelter except for Cuxhaven. I have been in the open with Annette when steamers have been having a lively time, but this sea did not affect steamers. The waves were only about 6 feet high, but hollow and breaking. So that day, Annette had her hardest testing. She came through all right, only two waves broke over the counter, and we arrived off Oost River at 1 p.m. On our chart, the Oost River was only shown as an inlet on the south side of the Elbe. No leading marks or buoys were shown, but there appeared to be a bar with 6 feet of water. We arrived at low tide, so we had some anxious moments when we crossed the entrance in sandy, broken water. We found that the river may be compared with the Hamble, though smaller. It has much the same kind of entrance, and once inside is well marked. After sailing round two bends, we anchored and turned in, glad of rest after our trying sail and the broken sleep of the previous night. I have laid stress in writing of the sea in the Elbe in order to warn the small yacht sailor of the difficulties of seeking shelter from heavy weather in any of the great German rivers when the wind is blowing hard against the fast ebb tide. The Outer Elbe lightship is 20 miles from Cuxhaven, the nearest harbour. Near high water, only negligible protection from the northwest is provided by the submerged sandbanks, and even at Cuxhaven, the river is so wide that, except in clear weather, one cannot see the other side. Chapter 11. The Gale at Rotham. We had almost given up hope of ever getting Annette back to England, when, to our great delight, the next day, August the 20th, brought with it fine weather. The barometer had risen to 30.3, and a nice breeze was blowing west-northwest. We got away at 7 a.m. with the first of the ebb to carry us down the Elbe, and at first our progress was good, as there was a nice wholesale breeze, although it was a headwind. However, it gradually fell off, and about midday it gave place to a dead calm, and the tide turned against us. We were near Elbe 3 lightship, and a big swell was running after the previous day's gale, but even that subsided considerably in the course of the day and enabled us to anchor out of the channel and slightly sheltered by the sands. At 5 p.m, the flood tide had slackened, and light airs enabled us to get underway and drift northwest over the corner of the Scharhorn, as part of this reef of sands was well covered. In this way, with the tide gradually helping us along more and more, we slowly drifted until we were off the Elbe 1, the outer lightship, at 9 p.m. The various lights could still be seen very clearly to help our navigation. Rottesand, Elbe 1, and the intensely powerful light of Heligoland in the distance. The wind had gradually backed to the south and freshened. I set a course for the Weser lightship, which lies 13 miles to the southwest, and gave the first watch of 2 hours to Dunsterville. Progress was splendid, and at midnight we passed the light vessel. We had been anxious for some time before, as the light on the lightship was apparently out of order, and an occasional flare was substituted, which could only be seen for a few miles. And even then, we did not definitely identify it as belonging to the lightship until we were very close to her. A steamer also experienced the same trouble and accompanied us at reduced speed until she picked up the lightship and altered course completely. The good weather did not seem likely to last long, as the glass was falling again, whilst the wind freshened and had temporarily veered slightly. Annette sailed fast to the west through the night, and when dawn came it revealed nothing but a desolate mass of broken grey waves with no land in sight. We sailed on, close-hauled and reefed in the hard breeze. The sea could not yet be called rough, but the swell from the west, indicating a probable shift of wind, combined with the steep, time-worried waves to make things unpleasant. We passed 2 barges under sail, foaming through the broken water, and at 9 a.m. spoke a fishing boat whose crew understood English and pointed out the direction of Nordnay. At 11 a.m. we made a landfall and saw in the distance the houses on Joist. The wind was south-southwest and blew hard, so it took us the whole day tacking for Borkum. The channels between the sands were very well buoyed just there, as big ships used them to make the port of Delfzyl. This was fortunate, as we experienced considerable discomfort from the increasing sea, from which we were unprotected by the submerged sands. Moreover, although the channels were well marked, navigation required care, as the low islands were out of sight and we were in the area of outlying shoals and strong tides. The North Sea pilot warns big ships to keep clear of this coast in bad weather, and one can imagine what a shocking place it must be under severe conditions. That evening we worked into the estuary of the Western Ems, and at 6:30 p.m. we let go anchor behind Rotum, a small round sandy island which is the most easterly of the Dutch Frisian Islands and faces, across the forked estuary of the River Ems, the German islands of Joist and Memmert, where we had sailed on the outward passage. We had made good 120 miles. Our anchorage was under the lee of the eastern extremity of Rotum. The island was narrow here, so it did not offer the best shelter, especially if the wind shifted, although there were sands which dried out to the north and south of the island, which provided some protection, at any rate, at low water. I had worked a net into a sort of pocket of deep water. Most yachtsmen would prefer something more secure as an anchorage, but I do not like harbours, and neither of us minded motion. I was very much influenced in my choice of anchorage by the Riddle of the Sands. In this book, Davies used to anchor the Dulcibella under the lee of any sands, reckoning that even at high water, when they were covered, they served as a kind of breakwater. 3 points escaped my notice. The first was that even if the water over the shoals was only a few feet deep at high tide, one can find a bad sea even in shallow water if there is enough fetch, and a yacht will ride uneasily in a gale if there is a strong tide. In the second place, according to the book, the Dulcibella's ground tackle was exceptionally heavy, no doubt much heavier than Annette's. Thirdly, Dulcibella was a heavily constructed centreboard yacht, an ex-lifeboat, while Annette was a lightly built keelboat. We had made good 120 miles and were dog-tired, as the navigation had been intricate and driving into the head sea had been very tedious. We were not to sleep long in peace, however, for at 4 o'clock the next morning we were awakened by the violent motion of the yacht. It was blowing a westerly gale, and a severe gale at that. It was high water, and the yacht was plunging violently, and the tops of the waves breaking solid over the bows and streaming aft, where they came trickling into the cabin. The wind was screaming at the rigging, and Annette was snubbing badly at her chain. The position was obviously very serious, and a tremendous strain must have been thrown on the ship. The immediate and urgent necessity was to give her more chain, and I miserably donned oilskins, preparing for a wetting. As I went on deck, 2 steep seas struck the yacht, and I clung to a runner for support. Crash! Crash! And Annette's bow suddenly paid off. I knew our cable, 5/16 inch and almost new, had parted, and we were being driven straight for the middle grounds, 1/4 mile under our stern. I knew also that it was useless setting sail, as there was no time to set the trysail, and the roller mainsail required setting before it could be reefed. Moreover, it was questionable whether canvas would stand up to such weather. It took some minutes getting the second anchor ready. I hurriedly bent onto it a new warp, thin but good, and heaved it overboard. It held for a moment, but I knew eventually it must break. Dunsterville came on deck and the two of us managed to heave a little of it in and bend another warp to it. Our weight in the bow made the waves break heavily aboard and there was a weight in the spray that drove over our heads. We had a lively time doing all sorts of odd jobs before we could pay out our second warp, making a total of 40 fathoms. Dunsterville might easily have been drowned, as he very sportingly volunteered to put a binding on the warp to prevent it fraying on the bobstay. He had to hang over the bows, which, pinned down by his weight, simply cut through the waves instead of lifting, so that he was often under solid water and in danger of being swept off his precarious perch. When he came aft, the ship rode more easily, and we remained in this unenviable position for 4 or 5 hours with the sea breaking on the sands now close astern, and only a 2-inch warp between us and a watery grave on the middle ground. It was only core rope, which is not strong, but probably its great elasticity and its long length, coupled with the fact that it was brand new, saved it from breaking. We were very wet and had nothing dry left on board to change into, and for some reason we were off our food. Altogether, we felt very depressed. At times, cruising is anything but romantic. Author's note, 1956. The cause of the break was probably that insufficient chain had been paid out, but after the incident I have always lacked confidence in chain, which is difficult to handle if it is of really adequate weight to prevent it being drawn but taut in a gale. In recent yachts I use chain for normal conditions, but for rough anchorages I rely on nylon of liberal circumference, which is not only immensely strong, but has the elasticity to prevent shock. 3 fathoms of heavy chain is shackled between the anchor and the nylon. The combination is virtually unbreakable. When the tide had run out and the wind moderated a little, we got under way for Delfzyl on the mainland. We hoisted a reefed trysail and a corner of the jib, and under this we sailed splendidly with the strong beam wind. With the help of the young flood, we must have made good 8 knots over the bottom. The channel was well buoyed and protected from the west by sands which had dried out. When in sight of Delfzyl, I went below to shave and get ready to enjoy a meal ashore. Dunsterville, however, inadvertently passed a middle ground buoy on the wrong side and put a net into the wrong channel, so that we had to beat back against wind and tide. We were in sheltered water, but there was still a steep sea and a terrific wind with spray up to the cross trees. Suddenly, the peak halyard lashed to the trysail parted and the sail fell with a run. We lost all the ground we had gained as it took me some minutes bending the sail to the throat halyard. Once again we slashed our way back to the wretched buoy that marked the division of the channel, and just as we were there we heard a tearing noise and the trysail split in two. I tried to get her into the right channel, but the sail blew to ribbons and down we went, straight for the middle ground sands. We worked feverishly to get some canvas up in time. The mainsail was in ties and the peak halyard right up aloft. Dunsterville took the knife and cut the trysail adrift and cut the mainsail ties, whilst I swarmed up the mast to recover the halyard. It was not exactly pleasant on the cross trees. The motion on the yacht was bad, but 30 feet aloft, it was 10 times worse. By the time things were in order, we had drifted right across the middle grounds, over a part marked quarter fathom, with only 2 hours flood tide under us. Sheer luck we had not touched. We hoisted the peak of the mainsail and reefed as best we could in the circumstances. The sail was new and made of heavy flax. It stood up to the gale, and within an hour we were lying safely to our kedge anchor off Delfzyl. We felt very pleased with life, but also absolutely sick tired. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.